what's going on, people out there? You got Johnny Hacksaw, and you're listening to Hacksaw Radio. Tonight is Friday, June 4th at 2:25 in the morning. Tonight on the show, people, you get the heart of Hacksaw Radio. You got Hairball.
Hello.
You got Avid.
Hey, what's up?
And you got me. What's up? Yeah. So, yo, everybody out there listening to this right now, you can go to HacksawRadio.com. That's HacksawRadio to download episodes of Hacksaw Radio and the Hacksaw Laser Show. This is episode number 11, the heart of Hacksaw Radio. This is the internet-only version of the show, people. So check it out tonight. It is an impromptu recording. We didn't plan on recording tonight, people. But because we love the scene so much, we're going to do this for you. So let's kick it off, shall we? I am Johnny Hacker, alright, previously known as Sinister 8, also known as one of the seven horsemen. I'm going to give you a little bios about me. I can't go into too much detail, obviously. But I started off in the scene when I was 9 years old, learning about the telco and the intricacies of telco, both with my local and then with my long distance. Since I was nine, I was young enough to pass it off as, you know, just being a kid out of curiosity. And I was really a lonely kid when I woke up, you know, and finally embraced the scene. How can I put this? One day I picked up a payphone, and I could actually read what it said on the little card underneath the keypad, you know, that tells you all the numbers you can dial and everything. And I dialed zero. I got connected to an operator named Samantha. She worked for Pac Bell. Samantha then in turn told me about the telco system and how it worked. She went ahead and she turned around and she told me how switching worked. Back then we had a DMS-100. DMS-100, of course, is still around today, but she told me how DMS-100 worked and how everything switched through DMS-100, how it could hold up to 6,000 exchanges on a single switch, and that fascinated me. I don't know why, you know. Some people say that, you know, true fascination comes from within the gut, and that is where the fascination came from, was from the gut, because with me, it truly felt that I was on the road to what I am today. Through all my trials and through all my tribulations that I've gone through. Because you have to realize that through my trials and through my tribulations, I grew up in a trailer park, you know, up to the age of 15. I was raided by the Secret Service at the age of 15. Subsequently, my mother kicked me out as a result of that, you know. And I'm actually proud that I grew up in a trailer park, because that helped me, you know, like, mold Johnny Hacksaw as you know it today. You know, Johnny Hacksaw, you know, rose above it all. I've been to prison twice, you know. I'm not proud of that. It was all bad decision-making, I guess you could say. Subsequently, it was my fault because I made bad choices, very bad choices, the people that I choose to surround myself with in a certain region, being the East Coast, because I was from West Coast, San Diego. And so I chose to associate with people that I just didn't even really know, basically, yet over the phone is the only way that I really truly knew them, you know. And these are people that said that they would never snitch me out. Yo, man, we're going to make, you know, if we're going to make this amount of money, you know, I'll never snitch on you. Fucking, you know the story. Yo, I'll hold it down, you know. Let me tell you something. When push came to shove, they told on me. You know, it was my mistake. Because rule number one, as Mr. Yaller said of Cyber Army earlier, in a previous conversation that we had with him earlier today on a conference that you guys aren't privy to listening to, you know, he also pointed out that, you know, you can't let people know too much about yourself and about what you're doing. You know, so like when you're in the scene, you know, you can't let people know what you're doing. You can let people know what you're doing, you just can't let them know how or where you're going to do it. Because before I was subsequently snitched out, I was doing great for myself. I was a millionaire, believe it or not, as a result of, you know, my skills. I had a beautiful mansion on the bluffs of La Jolla on Neptune Street, you know, right around in the, I won't say exactly where, but you can find it on MapQuest and the 6700 area, you know, pretty much the second biggest house before you get the to the curve on Neptune Street up towards the north end. So for all you MapQuest junkies out there, you can go check it out. There's a big pool in the back. It looks like a U on your screen. You can't miss it. It's the second biggest house on Neptune. I'm not afraid to say that now because that house is now owned by the FBI. And I'll get all, you know, into that here within the next maybe 15, 20 minutes. You know, but the reason why we're doing these little this impromptu recording is because each of us have a story that needs to be related to you guys, you know, for all our new callers, you know, and our new listeners. Since this is internet only, it's just our new listeners. For all of our pre-existing listeners, we need to get this out because between the three of us, you know, we have a lot of experience in the scene, you know, both with freaking, with hacking, with me, a lot of real world things, a lot of the way, you know, money changes a person, you know, and not necessarily the person. When I say the money changes a person, when you start gaining money, I may be going off the topic a little too early, but I'm going to flow with it because, you know, that's just the way I flow. But when you start gaining money, and I'm talking serious money, like, let's say over $100,000 a day, you know, no shit, over $100,000 a day. I know some of you cannot even imagine that, but I guarantee that it's possible, and I strongly recommend that you do it legally, because there are ways that you can do it legally. You know, it just takes a little more time, not much, about 90 days with real estate, but we'll get into that, you know, on another show. Maybe not even a show, maybe on a website or something. But when you start making about $100,000 a day to start, okay, we're not even talking like 15 minutes, but $100,000 a day, all right, and this is actual cold, hard, in your hands or in your backpack, in my case, you know, and you start spending that freely among your friends, you know, they start seeing that. They start feeling insecure about themselves. Suddenly, they envy you. That envy will turn into jealousy. You know, that is the way that it turns out. I'm sorry to say, but it just turns into jealousy. It really does. And it doesn't matter how much you try and spread that money around to your friends, they will still feel inferior to you. So the whole reason why I'm saying this is just, you know, don't spread the love too much, because you'll end up getting busted, you know. So what they'll do, like what happened to me, is they'll start plotting on you, you know. And it doesn't matter, you know, what the hell they say. They're gonna say everything to you, you know. I'll never snitch you out, you know. Look, man, I'm with you, you know, 12 to 22 hours out of the day, you know. We're tight, we're best friends, you know. You're the only guy I ever really trusted, you know. They'll say all this stuff to you, you know. And I'm saying this for the people that are about to become hacksaws. You know, people that are on the verge of knowing exactly where their hacking career is going. And when they realize that it's going to be going legit, that is when you become a hacksaw. You know, you got to be really careful who you associate yourself with. Because, like, in California, you are what you drive. In the hacking scene, you are who you associate yourself with. You know, that doesn't mean that everybody should become buddy-buddy with Kevin Mitnick because his handle is the most recognized in the scene. You know, I mean, so is Tron. You know, I'm not saying anything about Tron. Personally, I like Tron. You know, I think he gets blamed for a lot of fucked up shit that he doesn't do, you know. But generally in the scene, Tron is disliked, shall we say. You know, so if you associate yourself with Tron and only Tron, then it's just like being a prison, which I've been into. We'll get into that in a little bit. But, you know, it's the equivalent of being with a pedophile. You know, people are going to see that you associate with this person, so you must be best friends with them. Therefore, you must have the same mindset as that person. So you are not getting a full representation of yourself. You know, they're not giving you that fair, you know, equal balance. You know, their judgment of you, you know, if you care about judgment, which I really don't, you know. But if you actually care about judgment, then it's going to be, you know, tainted on the person perceiving you. They're just going to have taintment in their judgment of you. You guys want to add anything to this real quick? Am I right? Am I wrong?
I think you're on the right track.
What about you, Avid? Shall I proceed?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to continue kicking the knowledge. All right. So when you start, you know, mixing with the bad apples, shall we say, because they say one bad apple spoils a bunch, but I don't believe that. You know, that analogy is just total farce. Maybe over time, when the mold starts to grow, you know, to the other apples, yes. You know, but if you're able to be picked out of that barrel before the fungi gets to you, then you're still a right, you know, and, you know, you're still right. You're still a nice, juicy Macintosh, you know. I mean, you're still choice fruit. You know, so don't believe that just because you hang around with somebody that you're bad. You know, you may have different reasons, but, you know, if the majority of the people, you know, genuinely don't like that person for true and valid reasons, you know, maybe morally or ethically, then you definitely need to start reconsidering who you're hanging around with. Because in this scene, remember, just like in Hackers, I know. I'm making, you know, a reference to the movie that, you know, all of us hate. You know, but hey, I'm going to make it anyway. We are our own private islands. You know, just like I said in the Hacksaw Freestyle. You know, we are not friends, you know. We are friends on a personal level, but in the scene, we cannot truly be friends because we are just networking together in the name of digital science. You know, we are making that temporary alliance. You know, because we choose to make hacking and freaking our night job, shall we say. You know, because we can never quit our day job, whatever that may be. I mean, you could be mopping toilets. You could be, you know, you could be a cashier at 7-Eleven. You could be working at a telco. You know, you could be tech support for Yahoo. You know, but you never quit your day job. But being that we turn around and we have our night jobs, we all have a common bond together, you know. Therefore, we have to establish these alliances to further what is bigger than ourselves, to further a consciousness that is bigger than us, that will span further and longer than each and every one of us could ever hope or dream of. That is the true essence of the scene. To try and to get across to each a new person that comes into the scene, the quest for knowledge. Because whether you know it, whether you feel it with your whole body or not, that quest for knowledge will burn and tug at your soul for eternity, for all the days that you live in this limited life, in this mere shell that we possess for such a limited time. We have this quest for knowledge. We know that there is something blocking us from acquiring this knowledge, but deep down we know that with hacking and with freaking, possessing this knowledge of hacking and freaking is yet but a key to unlocking the true knowledge of that of which we seek. And that inspires us. That is what makes our soul burn. And we are not talking about the script kiddies that are out there trying to DOS a website. We are not talking about hackers. Yes, I said it, hackers. You know, because we are changing. We are raising the bar. Because we, as hacksaws, are raising the bar. Hackers are one thing, but hacksaws are in the pursuit of knowledge. You know, it is not no longer knowing what a system can do. It is not knowing what a system is, because we already know what a system is. We already know the boundaries of that system. Hacksaws are on the quest for knowledge. And that knowledge is the never-ending water that flows seamlessly. So you can never drive off of the trail as long as you are in the pursuit of knowledge, be that in hacking, in freaking, in life, in relationships. It all seems together. Never-ending pursuit. And that is what we are after. And for every one of you that can hear my voice, recognize truth, understand truth when I speak it, because this is what you are truly after, is knowledge. Do not ever forget that. We are not after websites to deface them. We are not after media to disprove them. You know, people have a lot to say about 2600. But when 2600 started, when they first started. When was it, Abbott? Back in like 84, 83?
It was 1984.
1984, when Eric, I'm sorry, Emmanuel started this. He was in the same pursuit of knowledge, a continuation of knowledge to pass on to you. And unlike everybody else, when I first came into the scene, I stumbled upon 2600 by accident. You know, we all have our own personal stories of 2600, you know, and how we stumbled upon 2600, you know. But when Eric started that up, he knew that he tapped into something bigger than him. When you realize that you tap into something that is bigger than you, you know that you have to pass that on. And what you are passing on is knowledge. And being that, you know, you may be a script kiddie, you could be just a plain programmer, you know. You could be working at your dead-end job doing nothing but C++ and visual. You still have knowledge that can be passed on. You know, they say the stupid question is the one that is not asked. That applies here. Because knowledge is encompassing. I don't have to tell you that. You know that deep down inside. You all know that. Every single one of you knows that. Am I right so far, fellas?
Absolutely.
Abbott?
Yeah.
Okay. So, we'll get back to me in a little bit. But right now, we'll go on to Abbott. Avid, how did you start out on the scene? How did you come across hacking, freaking? What did you first start in that came to where you are now?
I started taking telephones apart when I was about 7 years old with my friend, and we used to take apart other things like answering machines and basically anything electronic we could get our hands on. When I was that age, I used to just pick up the telephone and I would dial random numbers. And one number I remember in particular, dialing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, stars are a pound, and going in a reverse sequence back down, and it would make this strange siren noise. And I always like wondered why the telephone was making a siren. You know, did I set something off somewhere? Why the fuck is it doing that? I just like never figured it out, but until recently anyway. After that, one day I was at my friend's house again, the same friend. It's my best friend, by the way. And we were looking through some of his uncle's porn magazines and looking at the 900 numbers and seeing how they said, you know, they cost $3 a minute or what have you. So we started calling up those numbers, and some of the numbers actually had real-time verification of credit cards. So I got the bright idea of just typing in random numbers, trying to get one to work. This was when we were about 10 years old. At the same time, this is the first time we ever really encountered a voicemail system, and we used to try to crack that system too. That system was actually a SkyTel VMB, and I still remember that because we sat there for an hour trying to crack this thing without knowing why we were doing it or what we were doing, that it was potentially illegal or any of this. It just, out of like sheer curiosity and boredom, we were trying to figure out how to get into the thing. I don't know, after that, I basically got into a lot of radio and other communications. Had an old PC XT with the 300 baud Hayes modem. We used to dial up BBSs, and a different friend had his ham license, so we'd do packet radio on 2 meters for 40 centimeters. And from there, it just kind of escalated. I just got more and more interested in communications technology. And, to cut cut like a long story short, basically.
Well, don't cut a long story short. Just go on with the story, please.
Eventually,
these people need to know.
Okay. Well, as some people know who listen to the show, that I have an AOL account. I'm not afraid to admit it because I think AOL is cool. I also have a Comcast account. And I used to be into scripts, honestly, I'll admit it. And we used to download scripts a lot and mess around with those. And from those scripts, I just started clicking links on those pages and I started coming across these different things like Tone Lock and all these kind of programs. I said, oh wow, there's like more to it than, you know, just some fucking stupid punnet program. And is my phone breaking up?
No.
Alright, it's like hissing in my ear. One particular program that caught my attention, I'm trying to think of the name of it. I can't recall right now because I'm like fucking nervous. It's like, I feel like I'm put on the spot.
Don't worry about it, just flow with it.
Anyway, it said it would block your number from like, if you wanted to dial somewhere, it would hide your phone number. Which of course it didn't do, it didn't even dial *67, it was just total bullshit. But, started using war dialers and, I actually got to the computer aspect of it more first. Then I eventually stumbled upon a bunch of old 80s texts, which I think is like pretty much everybody's like first text.
Well, how did you stumble upon it?
Just through these same sites, just looking at all these programs and some of the same sites stuff, like blue boxing text files, and I recall reading a text file by the mod boss, and it was about blue boxing around the world in 10 easy steps, I believe that's the name of the file. It just fascinated me how it was talking that someone could sit there and route their call around the world and dial the payphone next to them, and I said, oh wow, and this is when I started getting the telephones, and basically everything I've done since then, I've never stopped thinking about Blue Box. That's the first true love, so to speak, that just truly fascinated me. I don't know.
Why did it fascinate you?
Just fascinated me that you could have total control and, well, not that I've got a control freak or anything.
But it was like, something that you weren't used to and you wanted to know more about it, right?
And it was like, it was something you weren't supposed to do that was the fascination too. Like, it's like, oh wow, you're not supposed to be able to do this. It's like illegal and you're not.
Well, did you know that it was legal at the time?
I knew it was illegal. I mean, that's like what, cause I've always been drawn to illegal things. Mm-hmm. And I just said, well, that looks like something I'd like to do. And so I started reading more about the phone system, and everyone always said, you know, blue boxing is impossible. It's no way it can be done anymore. So I just kind of put it on the fucking back burner and just kept it as like a fantasy, kind of, if you will. And well, then I started reading about the other boxes. If that one didn't work, well, which ones do work? And I went through all those, built most of the typical box stuff, like your pearl box, your silver box, all that kind of shit. And started messing around with that stuff. Actually, the first time I ever read box, my mother took me, and she knew exactly what I was doing, and she didn't care. She drove me right to the payphone, and I boxed a call, and we thought it was the greatest thing. I said, oh wow, I can steal phone calls from the telephone company. And I actually showed this to my grandmother, and she liked it too. She thought it was a good idea, and my grandfather as well.
Because it seemed harmless at the time, right?
No, we knew it wasn't right, but I mean,
how did your mom know about Redbox?
Well, I just told her about it, really. My grandmother's always been into telephones, too, like, way back in the 60s and shit, like, when you were only allowed to have one phone, and that phone that you had to be rented from Bell, and you couldn't have more than one phone hooked up without paying for it. Well, she had a bunch of telephones that she acquired on. She used to have about 6 sets hooked up in her house, and when she knew Bell repair was coming out, she'd go down the cellar, and she had them all attached with alligator clips to her T&I, so she just dropped the clips off. and they never found out about it. She still has a lot of that old stuff, like the four-prong connectors, and she gives me a lot of that stuff now. My grandfather says to me a while back, and she was cleaning out some of her phone stuff, you know, your grandmother has a phone fetish. I think that was kind of funny because, in a way, she was like, in her own way, she was defeating the telephone company, and not necessarily that, not that that's what freaking's about, but I mean, so I don't know. I just found it amusing. I'm trying to think of like what else to say.
That's okay, just go on with your natural progression of who you are today.
Oh,
in the scene.
Eventually I found Usenet, and I started posting the alt.freaking, and I read that for about a year before I started to post, and I was watching people out there like Dr. Seuss, MNX, the Phone Punks Network, Ocean City Phone Punks, and the International Information Retrieval Guild, the Loft, this all the stuff they were doing, and I just kind of like started reading that, reading their text files, and I met some people out there, and we started writing our own text files, which I won't give you the name of because they're horrible.
No, they're not horrible. What were you able to learn from them?
Well, like, all the stuff was basically, like, I don't know, like, we did a bunch of radio stuff, and I just basically plagiarized it from a book.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Well, that can't be horrible if that helped you be who you are today. You know what I mean? Because, like, we're not talking as in terms of being lame. You know, this is like, your progression to who you are now.
Well, basically, I thought, wow, like, a zine, like, people are going to read this, and I want to put something good in there, so, like, something that people don't know about. That's one reason we started doing, like, the radio section, because, like, not that many people are on the phones or, like, are into, like, ham radios and stuff like that. I don't know. It was just, like, a new experience, I guess. So that's why I started writing those files, even though they weren't really written. They were more plagiarized. I don't know. This is, like, kind of, like, piddly shit that I'm mentioning, but I can't think of what else to say. I don't know. We used to do a lot of scanning with analog phones, and I thought that was neat, that you could listen to people's phone calls, and until everything, like, started to go digital.
When's the first time when you realized, you know, once you were hardcore into the scene that, you know, like, being hacking or freaking, like, obviously freaking first, as it usually is the way with most of us, when did you realize that it was a lot bigger than you? You know, like, when we first start out, like what I've generally noticed with people that first start out with freaking, you know, like, in my case, I realized that, you know, that I thought that it was just me, you know, and my natural curiosity, as, you know, as you stated with yours, that, you know, it was just, you know, one person, you know, acquiring knowledge. When did you realize that, you know, that the scene, you know, when you came into the scene, that it was a lot bigger than you?
I didn't realize that for a while until I got on Usenet and I said, well, there's people out here, and I kind of narrow-mindedly thought that that's probably the last of the culture left. And actually, I don't know, I found other people who were doing little things, and I just kind of thought, like, you know, this shit's dead, even until, like, a few years ago, you know, like, I don't know, eventually I found, like, the Telco Inside site, and got hooked up down there doing new shit, like, and then I started reading, like, newer sites, like, Old School Freak, like, PPC HQ, which is down now, unfortunately. Then, I don't know, even then it still seemed like there was only a handful of people, and, like, every September, Usenet would die off, and cause everyone had to go back to school, and then in the summer it would kick back up again. You always wondered, like, the last time. And actually, last summer, I was thinking the same thing. I said, oh, everyone's gone again. They'll be back in September, but this time nobody came back, really. The Usenet on alt-freaking. There's no regulars out there anymore. It was just a bunch of kiddies asking for cellular codes. And, well, to get back to, like, the main thing, I didn't realize this...
There really is no main thing, though.
Well, I didn't realize the actual, like, impact of everything until, I'm trying to think, Low Tech of Dig Zine sent me the URL to BinRev, and I came across the BinRev forums, and I said, holy fucking shit, I cannot believe how many people are on here, I cannot believe the quality of this content, I just could not believe it at all. I was fucking fascinated that there was, like, a scene like that. It was
kind of... when you got to BinRev, like, what did you first start diving into that was on, like, the forums or, like, the text files that they may have had?
I went to the forums first, and I just stuck in the phone freaking, so I don't know, I wasn't really interested in computer hacking or any of that. Mm-hmm. Not anymore. Well, by the time I got there, I was kind of out of that phase.
Right.
So I just kind of hung around in there. I still read.
What did you start looking up, like, in terms of phone freaking?
Well, I went through there, and I read every single post in there, and, I don't know, then I just said, basically, I just made an account and started reading and posting. I don't really post anything too much that's, like, worth anything, but not because I don't want to, but because I don't really have much, unfortunately, to share anymore, anyway. But I don't know. It's kind of like the end of the story, I guess.
Up until now, right?
Oh, yeah, still, well, touching down on the Blue Box thing for a minute. Mm-hmm. I got hooked up with Telco Inside. Are you sure my phone isn't breaking off?
No, you're all right. You're coming across a lot better than you think you are.
All right. Cube is of Telco Inside. He founded Telco Inside, and he started, well, he didn't start, he was already writing Blue Box text, and he's hooked up with people like 9xFreak, who've been around forever, boxing, and I started reading that shit, and I said, oh, I can't fucking believe this is still possible, and eventually he wrote this journal called Sarge Journal, which you probably can't find anymore. I have a copy of it, though, if you want to get in contact with me, if you'd like to hear of that, because it's a great file.
How can people get in contact with you?
You could email me at avid@freaksandgeeks.com, P-H-R-E-A-K-S, obviously. And that, actually, thanks to Icon, the email address, that's his website. Was I gonna fucking... I feel like a fucking moron.
No, don't worry about it, man. It's alright.
Well, basically that, like, got me back in the, like, the thought of Blue Box, and I said, oh, I can still be dumb, and everyone's just full of fucking shit. Like, everyone just, like, listens to what one person says and breeds the fucking bullshit to everyone else who believes it, and it's just a fucking continuum of bullshit. And it's, to this day, like, people thinking, oh, silver boxes don't do shit, when in reality they do more now than they did back then, and you can't do this certain technique anymore, or you can't do it this way, you can't do it that way. Basically, all I have to say about that is don't fucking listen to those people. If you have a question if something works or not, try it for yourself, because, like, most likely it might work, and if it doesn't, you're probably going to find something interesting along the way. Just don't, like, buy into people's bullshit that shit doesn't work unless you've tried it for yourself. That's, like, a word of advice, I guess.
Well, in your opinion, like, why do you think that a lot more stuff out there that people say is dead, why do you think that it works a lot more now? You know, like, in terms of, like, blue boxing and silver boxing. And just generally what people say is just dead now, and you know for a fact is obviously not true.
Well, blue boxing doesn't work really in North America. Again, I'm not going to say that for 100% sure, because
right.
I don't fucking know. So I'm not going to spread bullshit. But it does work internationally. The silver boxes pretty much work anywhere where DTMF is recognized, which is pretty much the entire world. You can't do, like, a DNC or whatever the fuck it is, ADC on the directory assistance anymore, but still useful for PBX and things like that. I think the reason that, like, it's not that it works more today, it's that just people always said it didn't work, so nobody ever tried it. They just, like, bought everyone's bullshit and said it didn't work, and they just never even bothered to attempt it for themselves.
So do you think people are just regurgitating, you know, it's just bullshit that, you know, shit doesn't work by not testing it themselves? They're just like, you know, it's like, you know, the old phone game, you know, where they just repeat what they hear.
Yeah, people will hear something. I'm not saying everyone either, because there are obviously people who still try original things, but I mean, most people will hear things and repeat it as fact, and they haven't even tried it.
Which is the, you know, is like one of the natural basis that, you know, we stem from in the scene is, you know, just trying it for ourselves, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Parable, what got you up to this point? Like, how did you start out?
Oh, wow. This is going to be a long story.
Well, we got time, my brother. We got time.
Well, I was lucky enough to attend an elementary school that had a rather nice Apple IIe network. And at this point, most people probably didn't even realize that the Apple II computers were networkable. But in my first grade year in elementary school, we were introduced to a keyboarding class, which was mostly bullshit, mainly because the software we were using at the time, AppleWorks, you know, 12 years later, graduating high school, is antiquated so far to the point where it's not even Y2K compliant. But that's not really the point. The point is that I was introduced to this machine that was a little more unusual than your average piece of hardware. Whereas to, it would do what you told it. And if it did something wrong, it wasn't because, you know, it was broke, it was because you instructed it wrong. And very early on, I understood the concepts of a programming language. I'm not sure how many people out there are familiar with Apple Basic, but Apple II computers out of the box have a built-in Basic interpreter, and I picked this up very early on. And at my elementary school, every Wednesday, towards the middle of the day, you get to use the computer lab. And for the first half of the school year, all the Apple II computers were standalone machines, and, you know, they have their 360K 5 1/4 inch floppies with various software on them. A lot of you will remember the old Apple games, you know, Number Munchers, they had the Oregon Trail, stuff like that. For most of the people in the school, the computer was nothing more than a toy, and they made you type on. Well, I was really curious to how a lot of the stuff worked, and it came to the point where I would go there during recess instead of going to the playground, and I got real friendly with the teacher, and she showed me programming languages and stuff very early on. Logo was kind of an easy programming language to get learning. Well, I fell in love with computers so much, I asked my mother to buy me one for Christmas. I can't even begin to imagine what year this was. It has to have been way back, though. I'm going to say possibly 92. And this is a real big request, considering how computers were so expensive back then. And, you know, my mother was a single parent. She had lots of bills, and she worked at a grocery store making minimum wage back then was, I believe, you know, under $5, something on the lines of $4.35 or so. So asking for a $1,200 machine for Christmas is a long shot, and I don't know how she did it, but she bought me one. My first computer was a Tandy 1000 RLX, and had a VGA controller card and a single high-density 3.5-inch floppy disk drive. No hard disk. This was before hard disks were commonplace in computers, and, you know, that little machine could do so much, and the more you learned, the more you could do with it. And the great thing about machines like this is, you know, know, anybody who's introduced to computers nowadays, they have the mouse and they have Windows and they have, you know, sound and everything's point and click. But back then, you know, and MS-DOS and to the point where in order to use a mouse you have to load a driver and everything, you have to really learn a lot about computers before you can really use them. And I remember having the instruction manual, me as a second grader, barely knowing how to read, reading through a tech manual, trying to get the basic understanding of why when I type in, you know, a command, that in the manual it's supposed to be a valid command, it spits back at me, you know, required parameter missing, trying to figure out what a parameter is, you know. The instruction manual says copy is a command, but when I type in copy, it doesn't do anything. You eventually figure out that you got to type in more than just copy, and natural progression, and the more I used the machine, the more I liked it, because I realized the potential of this particular piece of hardware. Whatever I wanted to do could be done on this machine. I just had to figure out how to tell the computer to do it. MS-DOS came with a very, very basic scripting language called Batch. Batch files are basically a list of commands that you would run, sort of like a shell script, but a lot simpler. That had your basic go-to. You know, you can clear the screen. You could even send stuff to the PC speaker and make it beep by an advanced echo command. And I remember at the ripe old age of whatever I would be when I was in third grade, I write my first computer program. And basically all it was a choose-your-own-adventure game. It was written completely in Batch. You'd run the program by simply typing the name of the file, and it would be a story. At the end of each paragraph, you can make a choice on what you wanted to do and to continue. And based on anybody who knows anything about programming, it is a very, very easy thing to write, a simple, you know, choice program like that. But we're talking a third grader here. This is when most people are playing Nintendo and running their brains out by playing Mortal Kombat. And I'm learning more and more about computers. Well, eventually, one fateful day, I stumble across the yard sale. Funny thing was, I wasn't even really supposed to be going out that day, because I was grounded. But I was with my dad this time, and he kind of figured he'd give me a break, and, you know, Sunday morning is a good time to go yard selling. And I came across this this machine. It was a modem. And I really wasn't 100% sure what they were for. I remember seeing references to them and, you know, various tech manuals and stuff. And I knew that with this machine, you can connect to other computers, but I really wasn't sure, you know, how you go about doing that whenever. But it was only $1, and I figure, why not, right? So I buy this modem, and I bring it home, and I hook it to my computer, which is a little harder than it seems because you need the various cables. And I believe I actually had to fabricate my own cable because I didn't have money to buy one of them. I chopped up a printer cable and made the ends and everything, which, it's all good, you know? It's all about creativity.
Right.
And I hook this thing up, and what do you do with it? You can't anywhere to connect. And I eventually, you know, discovered that my local library had a telephone number that you can dial into one of their computers, and you can browse the internet. And this is when the internet was just first starting to hit the libraries, when it was a rather new technology, and, it was a text-based system, as most systems were back then. It was actually a very early version of the Lynx browser. And I would, you know, go to the library when I could and use the real internet. It was, at the time, it was Windows 3.1. But a lot of times, since, you know, I was at this point in the game, probably in fourth grade or so, I'm going through the story rather quickly, not really able to get places like that because how do you get a ride? You know, your parents, they work all the time, the, you know, single parent, all that stuff. It's a real pain, and I just sort of dove right into this. And basically, my mom would work all day, and she would get home, and she'd be busy all day long, and I just keep myself entertained on the computer, and just learn more and more, and the more I learned, the more I liked. Well, eventually, I came across a list of bulletin board numbers. And this list was really, really old. It was probably about 3 years old when I got a hold of it. And I went through each one of the numbers. and none of them worked, except for one. A Telerama public access internet. Don't remember the phone number, I remember it was a toll call at the time. I call it up, and it's no longer a BBS. Apparently back in the day it was a bulletin board system, but it had converted to what was called an internet service provider. And it was a company, you know, which a normal citizen could rent time on a machine and use the internet. And it was a text-based menu system. I believe they had, at this point, the point-to-point protocol on the system, but the majority of the users, I don't think, had that at this time. And I connected to this thing, and it said, you know, welcome. Enter your login name or type in new for a new user. And I'm a new user, so I typed in new, and I created myself an account. And at this point in time, it asked me what I wanted my username to be, and really couldn't think of anything, and kind of one of those defining times in your life. I had a kitten at the time, really cute little guy. I only had it for about 3 days, and it started hacking up, and it coughed up a hairball. Well, I figure, you know, the word Mike was already taken as a username. I couldn't get that. So I figured hairball, right? Who would have that? And, well, it signed me the account name and generated a random password and everything, and the guy from the company called me back to verify my account, and he told me I would have 14 days to try out the service, and if I didn't like it, I could cancel any time, no obligation. And I'm like, okay, no problem, you know? So I log onto the system with my newly created account, and it's all menu-driven. And one of the options was Internet Relay Chat. I had heard references to chat on various movies, namely The Net with Sandra Bullock. I'm sure we've all seen that before. And I kind of thought, hey, chat, I want to check that out. So I fire up the program, which is a menu option off this menu, not exactly much skill required at this point. And I couldn't figure out how to use it, being a command line base. It was actually IRCII. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Many people are. Couldn't really figure out how to use this program, but, you know, slash help. They had a pretty intensive help system. And I eventually figured out how to do your basic things like join channels and list channels and whatnot. And just by chance, the default server for that particular install of IRC was UnderNet, which back then had a pretty good reputation of being an underground place where people discuss, you know, computer hacking in general. I did a list which showed you what channels were available on the server, and the internet was really small. This was in 1996. Not many channels back then. I mean, there was a lot, but nothing like there is today. It listed them in alphabetical order. One of the first ones I saw was pound AOL, and I'm thinking to myself, hey, I know someone that's American Online. I wonder if I can chat with them. So I joined this channel, and there's like three or four people in there, and I asked them, hey, is this American Online chat? And they're like, oh, sorta. What do you want? And kind of explained my situation. They informed me that this is not the AOL chat that I thought it was and everything, and I'm kind of disappointed this time, and I back out of the system, and I do another list command, and being alphabetical order, it lists numbers before any alpha characters, and even though last time pound AOL was, I believe, the first one listed, there was a new one listed. It was pound 2600, and I'm like, well, that wasn't there before. What's this? I joined the channel just in time to hear someone say, no, 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 keep it plus S. We want this channel secret. And only later did I find out that that channel was only minus S for about 10, 15 seconds. And if I had not done that list command at precisely the time I did, I would have never seen that channel there. I would have never joined that channel. And I would have never been introduced to this hacking scene. But this is 1996. Pound 2600 on the internet. And my first question is, what's 2600? Now, if you try that today, they're going to kick you out real quick for being an idiot, but back then people were more tolerable, they were helping one another, and I actually had someone spend a good bit of their time explaining to me that 2600 was a magazine about computer hacking and what computer hacking was about, and I was hooked right off the get-go. You know, not because you can get things for free or because you can get access to machines, but it's about doing things that you're not supposed to be able to do as far as making things work that aren't supposed to work or finding creative ways to get your end goal. And it's just one of those defining moments when only later, looking back, do I realize that if I had not done that list command at precisely the time I did, I would have never been exposed to hacking. I mean, I may have, but certainly not to the level I was, because the person on there, they explained to me in depth exactly what things were, and it was a real, real defining moment. Well, I started to hang out in the channel regularly. Every single day after school, I'd dial for about an hour or two and chat with the regulars, and well, there was this guy on there. His handle was Crime, K-R-I-M-E. And one day, we used to talk about, you know, stuff. I never really talked too hardcore. One day, he sent his quit message to, anybody wants to call me, here's my phone number. So I figure, hey, why not, right? No, I'm not paying the bill. So I call up this phone number in Orlando, Florida. And I talk for a good hour and a half. And that person was Eric A. Schulman, who currently runs Scope 6 Security. And I've known him since way back, and again, if it wasn't for me doing that list command, I would have never met him either. Well, eventually I upgraded my computer to a 386, I installed Microsoft Windows 3.1, and get a graphical web browser, and I move up in the world and, you know, discover, you know, MIRC, which I believe was version 2.04 at the time. And I decided to start contributing to the scene. One of the sort of things I do is, you know, of course I'm reading up and learning new things every day, and redboxing was really popular back then. This is about 1997 now. And it was still very possible. It worked all over Pennsylvania, which where I was at the time. And I had my little, you know, tape recorder and my little audio tapes and everything. And I used to have a lot of fun going into this parking lot about 2 in the morning on a Friday night and just sitting there with the phone in my hand, just dialing calls all over the world. And, you know, it's cold out, it's going to be wintertime, the air's real crisp and has that electric smell to it, and you got a payphone in your hand, and it's all quiet, and the only thing you hear is the white noise in the background. And it's like, you know, you dial the number, and you hear the clicks, and it comes on and says, you know, please deposit $2.40 for the next 3 minutes, and you just play it in there, and just clicks through and says, thank you for using AT&T, and just puts you right through. And then it's not so much you really want to rip up the phone company. I mean, I wasn't even calling people I knew. I was just calling just to have the sense, the feeling that I'm sitting here and I'm causing these machines all over the U.S. to route this call. And it's just a sense of learning, of understanding how these things work. Well, eventually I got the great idea that this is something that you want to pass on. So my first contribution to the scene was a computer program, and if I had known, you know, that the word Redbox is a fairly common search term, I probably would have named it something else, because I, to this day, can't find a copy of that program. But I was coming to be a pretty good basic developer, if there is a such thing as a developer in the basic programming language, but Microsoft DOS 6.22, which was the operating system I had, you know, underlying Windows at the time, had a quick basic interpreter that came with it, and I got pretty good with it. And I tell you what, it's pretty hard to drive a sound card in Quick Basic, but it definitely can be done. I made a program that you could redbox, you know, with a regular Sound Blaster compliant card, and it had all the bells and whistles. It had macro support, it had delay support, it had, you know, noise integration, and it was a really, really nice thing. And I published this, and you know, me, the lonely guy that joined the channel like 2 years before, had no idea what he was doing. You know, and all of a sudden I'm coming with this program, and people were impressed, and I actually became a channel operator of the channel. And, you know, that doesn't sound like much, but that channel was pretty popular back then, and not very many people were operators in that channel, and that was kind of like a reward. It was like these people telling me, you know, this hairball guy, I see you going places, you're doing a good job, and they made me an operator of the channel, and that was actually, you know, one of the things that kind of reinforced that I'm heading in the right direction. Well, heading into 1998, I was getting some bad grades in school, and my dad liked to blame it on the fact that I was on the computer all the time, which it was really unrelated. I was actually on some mind-altering medication that I had a lifetime prescription of due to some mental problems that I was diagnosed with many, many years ago due to an unrelated incident. And my dad thought it would be a good idea to take me off this medication, and it was I'm sure it's similar to Ritalin. It was just an attention medication, nothing real special. without that, I had a really hard time concentrating, and because of this, my grades started to drop and whatnot. And as a punishment for not getting straight A's, like I had up until that point, he decided that he would stop paying my internet bill. Well, by this time, I had learned enough about computer hacking that obtaining passwords was, you know, not out of the question. I didn't really want to steal the service. I would have paid for it if I had any way to make money. It was only $20 a month. I mean, a dollar a day, you know, doing some chore would make me enough money to pay the bill, but, you know, my dad wouldn't pay me to do anything. I couldn't, you know, kind of contain to the house. So, eventually I get a hold of the password file for my local provider, run it through an early version of John the Ripper, and I crack about 600 of the passwords in a course of 3 days. And 1998, by the time this rolled around, I have a decent machine. It was a Cyrex 120, if anybody remembers the old Cyrex machines. And I start using these accounts, and it's really no big deal, because unless the same person is on the same time using the account, they don't even notice. But I did something kind of stupid. I realized that each of these passwords also had shell accounts attached to them, and I gave a few of the passwords out in the channel. People were running early versions of Eggdrop, connecting to the channel, and the systems administrator, a guy by the name of Michael Halling, comes on one day, because all these accounts that haven't been used ever on shell all of a sudden have bots installed, and he wants to know what's going on. And in the entire channel, I was the only person who had an IP address belonging to that company, and my name on IRC was Hairball, and since that was the name my account used to be registered into, it was fairly simple for them to do 2 plus 2 and figure out that, you know, Michael Wally is the guy who hacked their system and has all the passwords. And the guy's real cool about it. We do a direct client connection chat, and he kind of tells me, hey, you can't be doing this, and we strike up a little deal. He says, I tell him how I got the password file, and, you know, tell him some other problems with the system, and he'll just give me an account I can use. It doesn't really cost him anything anyway. Well, I go ahead and do that, but apparently, somewhere along the line, I believe it was Mr. Hulling's supervisor, decided that, no, this wasn't going to happen. And they got the FBI involved in the situation. Unfortunate timing had it that the FBI was forming a new branch called the Computer Crimes Division, and they needed some justification for all the funding they were getting. And I was told that was their first case, or their first major case. I don't know how major an ISP hack is. I mean, nowadays that's nothing, but back then, I mean, computer hacking, although it was still, you know, kind of popular, they really didn't know what they were doing. Well, on I believe it was June 16th, 1998, I got raided by the FBI, and they take all of my machines, which were only three at the time. I didn't have that much hardware to lose. And I get charged with a few bogus crimes, illegal use of computers and whatnot. And it was a really bad time in my life. Got charged, I lost all my computer equipment. I got grounded, and I mean like hardcore grounded, for 6 months. I was still failing everything at school. And to top it all off, my mother got murdered by her drunken ex-husband, or not ex-husband, but ex-boyfriend. And it was a really, really messy situation. But it's one of those things you gotta just wing it out. You gotta just keep going. You gotta keep plugging. You know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Well, I got probation for 2 years. I'm not allowed to use a computer or telephone for those 2 years. I was forced to go to drug rehab. As a 16-year-old, never having touched a drug in his life or never having seen most of them, being forced to go to a drug rehab school with some really not-so-nice people who were sitting there twitching because they needed some crack, and, you know, they were barely older than you, was, you know, I never really had an anger management problem until I went to that class, because, tell you what, man, if you don't know it, people who are addicted to drugs are some of the most aggravating people in the world. Well, eventually I work everything out, and I get graduate from a little drug rehab class, which basically is a joke. It's just a big money-making scam run by this company. They charge $300 a day for every kid that's in there, and they don't do anything with you. But that's beside the point. I get all free and clear and everything, and because my mom's unfortunate death, I get a large amount of life insurance money, which I intended on investing in certain companies. That it didn't go off so well. That's another story altogether, which I'll probably get to that in the near future. Well, at this point, I'm on my own. Got a small little apartment in, you know, a city called Lower Rural Pennsylvania. I'm in the school there, and things are going okay, I suppose. My high school kind of gets on my nerves because it was one of those deals where the principal kind of thinks that he owns people, and while you're at that school, you're under his rule, and you don't have rights and all that stuff. And I ended up making a website, a forum system, where people in my high school can talk about some of the stuff that happens there without, you know, being censored or whatnot, because some of the stuff that went on in that school was unbelievable, some of the abuse of power and administrative injustice and whatnot. And I gave the people a forum to talk about it, and since it was outside the walls of the school, the principal really had no authority there. And I got disliked by a lot of people, the staff, and I got kind of famous by the rest, the students, and that was all doing fine, and I was back on top, back where I thought I belonged and everything. And this was about 2002, I do believe, yes. And I go to HOPE, the H2K2 convention. Actually, I went to 3 conventions that year. My first one was SummerCon, which was in Washington, D.C. That was my first convention, and in all honesty, I thought it was great until I saw the other ones. Not sure if any of you have been to SummerCon before, but it's kind of bland. There's only maybe like 50 people there, and nothing really exciting happens. The next con I go to is, I can't remember if DEF CON or H2K2 was next. I'm going to say DEF CON, but I could be wrong. DEF CON is great. It was DEF CON 10 at the time, like I said, 2002. Meet a lot of interesting people. Bump into a guy named Chaz there, and I still deal with him today. He lives in Las Vegas. He's local to the con and everything. And moving up, making connections, meeting new people. And then I go to H2K2. Now, this is irony at its best. I mean, it doesn't get any better than this. I go to this convention. I show up a day early. And they're setting up a public network. Great thing about the HOPE series of conferences is if you don't have your own machine, you can use one of theirs. They have public dummy terminals and low-end machines that run Xserve and you know, hardware-based operating systems that connect to a mainframe server, and it's pretty cool how they got it set up. And I noticed that every one of the computers there had a sticker on it that said, "This cool toy belongs to Telerama." I'm thinking to myself, that can't be the same Telerama that I hacked in 1998, can it? This is about 4 years later, and everything's blown over and everything, and I'm like, surely this company doesn't promote hacking. Well, I asked around, and I find out not only is all this equipment been donated by Telerama, the same company that I hacked in 1998, but the systems administrator, Michael Halling, the person who I had personally spoke to on IRC conversations, and he was actually running the show there. So I made a point to, you know, talk to him for a nice half an hour or so before I finally introduced myself, and he was even more shocked than I expected seeing me there, and, you know, finally got to take a look at me for the first time. And towards the end of the con, he actually apologized for what happened and informed me that it was the supervisor made him do it, and no hard feelings and stuff, and he actually gave me an entire dumb terminal network, 16 terminals, a controller, all the keyboards and cables to make it work. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, again, you know, this is someone that helped put me away, and here, to less than 4 years later, I'm making friends with the guy. I just think this is one of the greatest things ever. I invest some money with a guy in Chicago. I met him at DEF CON. And he ran a website called BeAHacker.com, and he made this really great deal with me. He says, "Listen, Mike, I'm selling all these products, getting a little out of hand. I need someone to help me with a project. If you ship out these products, you know, it's mostly CD-ROM information," and kind of feel guilty taking something that I felt should be free information and turning around and selling it. But I knew that the people who had the knowledge to look could find it all for free anyway. And I figured the only people willing to pay for CDs is the people who were either, you know, too clueless to ever really figure out what it's about anyway. So I entered into agreement with this guy to sell these CDs, and my job would be to simply copy the CDs, and mail them every time an order was made. He would do all the paperwork, and he would do all the administration. He would do the webmastering and everything. And there was a catch, though, as I had to chip on an advertising campaign, and I'm not sure if any of you ever advertised in magazines before, but it gets kind of expensive. It was a $40,000 advertising campaign that involved a full-page ad in the magazine over several months, and I had to ship in half. So I had the money in the bank, and I write him a nice fat check for $20,000, and we sign a 3-year contract saying that I get half the money generated, you know, for 3 years, and all this and that stuff. And eventually, he's like, hey, you know, this is working out pretty well. I got my first 3 or 4 checks. He was paying like he was supposed to for about 4 months, and he's like, well, you're into this stuff. Why don't you come out with some new products? At the time, I was playing with Motorola analog cell phones, and I was learning the programming codes and whatnot. So I was like, well, you know, hey, we can buy these things off of eBay, and we can resell them fairly inexpensively, or fairly expensively, buy them cheap and sell them for a lot based on what can be done with them. So I thought I'd get us a little CD-ROM, has some custom software in there, helps you program the phones, and design a little web page saying, you know, you can do this with this phone, you can do this and this, and then a lot of things you can do with those old phones is kind of amazing. You can, you know, Abbott mentioned listening to calls. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can do with those phones. Well, I saw these on the internet, and I go on eBay, and I decide that it's probably the best idea to corner the market. Being eBay was, it wasn't new, but it definitely wasn't anywhere near how big it was today. I bought every single Motorola analog phone I can get my hands on, a little over 1,200 in all. I paid between $20 and $25 a piece for the phones, so we're looking at over $30,000, $40,000 investment on these phones, but it was all good, because I was turning around and I was selling them for $150 a piece. Well, I also gave a whole bunch away for free at my local 2600 meeting. I gave them out like candy, all my friends had one and everything. One of the things these phones could be used for would be for dialing 911. And, you know, even though the phone is not registered to anybody, it still has to go through because it's an emergency call. And I was giving the people like my friends and be like, keep this in your car. You know, if you ever break down, you could just dial 911 and, you know, call a tow truck or whatnot. Even though there's no service, it'll still work. And one of the things advertised on the website selling these phones was that you can call 911 without being traced. Now, what I was actually meaning by that is if you wanted to call in like a tip, you know, you wanted to rat somebody out or something, let's say your neighbor's selling drugs and you're sick of them and you wanted to call in a tip but you don't want to come back on you, there you go. Well, apparently this was explained to me a little later on that it was believed that one of the phones I sold was being used in some terroristic threats on my old high school. And it was very well known that I didn't like my high school. It was very well known that I had these phones and I had the knowledge to be doing something like this. I'm not quite sure how it happened, but December 19th, 2002, a little past 6 a.m., I was raided by the FBI for the second time in my life. They came and they took a little more than they took the first time. I probably lost all in all about $150,000 to $200,000 worth of equipment. I had not only all the cell phones, I had some really high-end networking equipment. I had some nice server equipment. I had a 20, you know, device CD duplicator you can stick in, you know, master and 19 blanks and run off copies in like 10 minutes. Copy machines, lots of really, really nice office equipment. But, you know, I was turning around selling these cell phones. I was making a good bid on them, too. So, all of a sudden, my net worth drops from about $250,000 down to about $50,000. But, you know, it's one of those things. You gotta work through it. You gotta work your way back up to the top. And I'm a firm believer that no matter how broke you are, you play your cards the right way, and you'll be back up on top within a few months. And I've proven that to myself time and time again. Well, didn't work out the way I expected to. My connection in Chicago, the person who I had the 3-year contract with, stopped sending me my checks, and the contract was actually taken in the FBI raid, so I wasn't able to get a copy of that. I later found out that the contract was signed while the person was a minor. And apparently the attorney who did the paperwork didn't check IDs. I'm not sure if I have any basis to sue him for not doing his job as a notary or whatnot, but all I know is I kind of lost a lot in that process, and I was being harassed by the FBI, and I was being followed around town and everything, and I said, you know what? Pennsylvania's not for me. I packed my stuff and I left for Orlando, Florida. My whole intention of leaving for Orlando, Florida was to meet up with an old buddy, Eric A. Schulman. I moved down to Orlando, I get an apartment, I set up and everything, and looking for a new project to start. You know, I can't sell the cell phones because apparently those are a bad idea. And I'm thinking, you know, what can I do for an account? I mean, for a project. At this time, I was running a shell account off of a company in Pittsburgh called Infobon, which is one of the competitors of Telerama. You know, even though I'm cool with the guy, they still won't give me an account anymore, some kind of internal policy. And I came to the conclusion that why do I want to pay for a shell account on my box when I can just run my own server? If I get an old machine I had laying around, I throw a free BSD on it, and I, you know, start using it for my own purposes. And I get the great idea that, you know, maybe I should give away some shell accounts to some of my friends, because after all, a really good shell is hard to come by. And at the time, this is shortly after the .us domain name is deregulated. Previous to this point, the .us was restricted for government use only, you know, like state.pa.us and whatnot. And they had just deregulated it. Domain names were going fast, and I know if I wanted to get a good domain name, I had to go right away. I originally wanted to get hb.us for hairball, but the minimum you can get was a three-letter domain name, so I just figured HBX. Really wasn't even aware of what HBX was at the time. I honestly just wanted HB for hairball. Only later did I find out that HBX is actually an explosive chemical, which makes the name all that much cooler. Anyway, I fire up a FreeBSD machine on, you know, a nice 400 megahertz machine, you know, real slow for the time, but still pretty decent. It's called shell@hbx.us, and I give them out to a few people. Within, you know, a week or so, I got maybe like 100 different people using it, and I wrote some scripts that I made to process and everything, and before you know it, I got a small little organization going here, so I scale up some cash, and I file for nonprofit, register a business in the state of Florida under the name HBX Networks, and that's all going great. I'm writing software and, you know, Visual Basic at the time, and publishing informations and whatnot, and working with a few other companies doing this and that. And well, eventually, a guy by the name of Lamer Joe, which listening, you may or may not know of him. He's a real wise guy. I used to participate on a all the time on a voice bridge called the PLA Voice Bridge, and I met this guy Lamer Joe there, and he was a real weirdo, but he was kind of fun to hang out with, and he was funny and everything. And he found out that my landlord was gay, which I kind of messed up by telling him, and he thought it would be a real fun prank to fax my landlord gay pornography. And he kind of used my phone number on the cover sheet, and before you know it, I had a lawsuit for harassment, I had an eviction notice, and my car was mysteriously towed from in front of my apartment because of expired Pennsylvania plate, which was technically true, but yeah, that was definitely, you know, intentional because of the harassment suit and everything. And at this point, my net worth dropped to maybe 20 grand I had left. I don't know if any of you have been to Orlando, Florida or not, but getting a job there is pretty difficult, too. Basically nothing. So I said, something's got to give. I liquidated all my assets, took a plane ticket to Las Vegas. Thinking, Las Vegas, man, you know, if you can't get a job there, something's definitely wrong. I basically abandoned the HBX project. I sold off all the hardware. I kept the corporate name, kept the binder with me, have all the membership certificates and the paperwork and everything, but kind of let it slide for a while. Went to a budget suites in Las Vegas. I started looking for the classifieds. I spent what little money I had and got a job doing all things telemarketing, which sounds really nasty, but it pays well and you get commission and everything. And doesn't work out for me. I ended up getting fired for breaking a window in my hotel room, which was totally bull. Apparently the foundation was shifting in the building and whatnot. And at this point, I am so incredibly broke. I mean, like, so broke to the point where I don't got any money, not even, like, $10. So I grab my stuff, and I'm like, okay, I get back to Pennsylvania. No, screw Pennsylvania. Where else do I know people at? I knew people in Texas. I knew people in Virginia, I knew people in Oregon, I knew people in Los Angeles, and I come to the conclusion the only person I trust enough to basically stay with to get my feet was a good friend of mine named Chris, who I met at H2K2 in Newport News, Virginia. So the question becomes, how do you get from Las Vegas, Nevada to Virginia with no money? Well, I decided to take a risk, and I went to a truck stop, and I managed to hitchhike all the way from Vegas to Virginia, just under a week and a half. And I gotta tell you, it's one hell of an experience. It's definitely something everyone should experience at least once in their life. You get to meet a lot of nice people. You get to see the whole U.S. And it's not as scary as people would think. I mean, if you're a good judge of character, you know who not to take rides with and whatnot. And it was a pretty fun situation. And when I finally arrived in Virginia, meanwhile, this whole time I had been investing money previous to me even going to Orlando, had invested about $20,000. This is actually previous to me getting raided the second time. And I was doing a website. I had done the website for my local high school, the one I mentioned earlier that they kind of kicked me out of the school for doing, which I guess I didn't mention. I actually got expelled for that website indirectly. Can't prove that was what it was for, but that's what it was. Such a big hit, I made the local paper and everything, and I decided to take it on a national level, and I paid a Java developer in Los Angeles about $24,000 to develop a website for me. It involved buying some high-end server equipment, buying some other, you know, miscellaneous stuff, and, well, he never did any of the work, so by the time I hitchhiked to Virginia, you know, Chris, he's a PHP developer, so I'm kind of like, well, maybe we should start this project back up again. So I called up on the phone, I'm like, listen, I called the guy in Los Angeles, you know, you haven't done any of the work, I want my machines back, and apparently he spent all the money on who the hell knows what, and he only had one computer and everything, so he sends me the one server he does have to Virginia, and I, you know, FedEx and everything. It's a really nice machine and everything, and me and Chris Guy, we start working on what is going to be the School High project, and we developed this independently, and eventually decided that, you know, I still have a corporate name in Florida, might as well, you know, develop School High under the HBX Network's name, keep it a non-profit, keep all the money in the project, and we start banging it out and everything, and, you know, Chris, he was still living with his mom at the time, even though he had a full-time job. He was basically supporting her, as it were be. And eventually, I had to go, because, I don't know, it was just a weird situation. One day, everything was cool, and the next day, I was hitting the streets, so Virginia's not too far away from my hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so I ended up taking a Greyhound there, and basically told my dad, hey, I'm out of luck, I need to, you know, had some money in storage with him, like a doomsday fund type deal, and borrowed a little bit out of that, and kind of got an apartment and everything, and that's where I discovered that my uncle is a very, very rich man. I mean, I knew my uncle had a business and all, but, you know, one day I'm in my cheesy little efficiency apartment, and sending out Christmas cards, and I happen to notice that his address is about 3 blocks away from my address. So I sent him a Christmas card and everything, and put my phone number in there, and my aunt calls me up one day, and she's like, hey, Mike, why don't you come up my place for a bit? We haven't talked for ages. And I go up there, and we talk for a bit, and I tell her basically all the stuff I've been telling you guys, and she's like, I'll tell you what, if you want to get back on track with business, Emil has a storefront property down the road he's not using for anything. I bet you lease it to you real cheap. Talk to him about it, and all of a sudden I had a store. And all of a sudden I had a server. I call up Verizon, and they're willing to give me phone lines on credit. And I end up getting a job, and I end up, you know, having, I restart HBX, I start the shell project up, I have, within 3 months, I had like 6,000 users. I get my phone lines going, and I reestablish all the connections I used to have, I'm fixing computers on the side for cash, and all of a sudden I'm slowly racing to the top for the third time in my life. That's pretty much where the story ends for now. It's where it goes from here. It's anybody's guess, but I have a feeling that it's going to float all the way to the top and possibly a little higher than that. But it all started from me going to my local elementary school and being exposed to an Apple II computer, and then me by chance going to a yard sale, by chance buying a modem for a dollar, by chance, stumbling across a phone number who belonged to an internet company, setting up for a new account, and by chance, happening to do a list command on an underground IRC network in a 10-second window that shows me a hidden channel, which introduced me to a whole new crowd of people. End up meeting the system administrator of that network at a hacker convention many years later. It's quite an interesting story, and it's still got, you know, many, many blank pages to be written.
Nice.
Yeah, it's me. HBX is starting to take off real hardcore, and I see it going places.
I guess, finally, for, to wrap up, I'll go ahead and, get into a little detail, on my end here. Basically, started out, like I said, in the phone company when I was about 9, just by talking to operators. Being that I was so young, you know, they were pretty eager to tell me pretty much everything about the operation at the telco, the way different switches worked, giving me special phone numbers for, like, loop numbers, different things like that. Mind you, this was back in 1987. Quick synopsis. With that information, I then went down to my local telco, which was Pac Bell in Chula Vista, California, which is a city, smaller city of greater San Diego, down towards southern South Bay area, where there was a bank of payphones, where most of the linemen and phone techs that worked for the phone company would go, like, on their lunch break and over the phone go ahead and put in work orders and tickets and whatnot. So I would make, like, I'd go to one of the payphones that wasn't being used. There was a bank of maybe 8 payphones. This is going back a ways, so there was about 8, I believe, maybe 6. But I would try and get in close with the switch techs, try and get into a phone booth that was close to them, and I would try and severely listen hard to what they were saying over the phone, because I knew what tickets were. I knew that they were, you know, that they were the end task of work orders. And so I would listen to how, you know, they would put in tickets for different things, you know, new activations for phone lines and stuff, because back then they didn't use the actual customer's line to push through tickets. They would actually do it either at the central office or on their lunch break back then. And I learned how to do that. With that information, I then went into long distance. Back then was, I believe, it was just the Big Bell, AT&T, and stuff. And then with that knowledge, I would go ahead and push through tickets for, you know, basic news services. So that way I could keep my line into the telephony world and telephonically and whatnot. I discovered a certain batch of loop numbers in my local area that out-of-state phone freaks and hackers would call. I started talking with them. They then gave me the number to different conferences. Back then, Alliance and AT&T were popular phone conferences back then. So instead of me, I went ahead and I called. I would listen because, you know, mind you, I'm only, you know, when I finally mastered, I was 11. When I finally mastered the phone system, I was about 11 years old, 11, 12. I believe I was just turning 12 when I knew everything about the phone system there possibly was to know in 1989, 1990. I knew just about everything, you know, possibly to know about the phone system then. So I would go ahead and I would call up these Alliance conferences that I was given by a group of hackers that didn't even really have handles back then. They went by original names. and I would just listen, you know, because these people are obviously more superior than I was, like, in terms of hacking. And little did I know that I was coming in on the brink of out with the old, in with the new back then. This was in the course of 1990 to 94. And in 94 is when DEF CON originally came up. I believe it was 94 is when the 801 DEF CON came up, I do believe. Which was unofficially 702, but I'll get around to that. So I would listen, and I would listen and listen for the course of about anywhere from 4 to 6 months. Not say a word, I would just listen. And every now and then, you know, I would go ahead and when somebody would talk about, you know, the telco and, like, exploiting the telco, I would go ahead and chime in. You know, like, if I knew somebody was wrong, I would chime in with the correct answer. Like, you know, if somebody was telling, you know, another person how to push through, you know, an activation ticket for a new line, you know, at a, like, let's say, an address that didn't exist. They were basically just activating a pear off the tree, you know, off of the pear tree and stuff back then. I would go ahead and chime in on how to do it with the ticket, you know. And this got me noticed very fast because it was right, you know. And I stumbled upon this by, like, what I learned from the phone technicians and what I learned from the operators. So instead of actually reading about stuff, I had pretty much firsthand knowledge from, you know, from the switch commanders, because when I would talk to the operators, if they didn't have an answer for me, they would transfer me. You know, I mean, I think it was very crucial for me, because for them just to transfer me, like, to the switch, you know, just out of, you know, the grace of their heart, you know, just out of wanting to know more about how the actual system worked, you know. Maybe they saw something in me where, you know, they thought I might want to work for the telco one day. I'm not sure. But I was able to learn a lot of knowledge about the internal workings of the switch from the actual switch commanders and everything. So I was able to provide a lot of good information to people in the freaking scene. And it also in the hacking scene as well. Because, like, hackers and mainly hackers wanted to know how to divert their calls when, like, the true elites, the hacksaws of that time wanted to know how to crack into systems and methods of diverting their calls through ghost lines, which were basically phone numbers that had no address, which was basic switch assignments, different switch logins, and the dial-up numbers for that without actually using OB in there in person. So with that knowledge, I was able to trade, you know, trade information, much as we do today, but back then was when it was really instituted, you know, so I was able to trade a lot of freaking information for hacking information. And that's how I got my start into computers, because I figured, well, I learned everything about the phone system. And computers seemed like a more of a vast, vast means of acquiring knowledge of how things worked than freaking. Because as some freaks believe, you know, the telco is, like, you know, unlimited, but it really is. I mean, there's only so much you can do both locally and, you know, long distance, including international. But with hacking, it's unlimited because everybody has a terminal. You know, each system is unique, even if they run the same operating system. Each system is unique based upon the user. So I was able to learn how to get into corporations and business computers by getting into a regular like networking strategy to where, you know, you dial into, you go ahead and you call up the receptionist's computer that doesn't have a firewall, you know, as in, you know, like which, you know, which they have now. But they had like different interfaces and whatnot. So I was able to network. That was to quote Hairball, the man in the middle. So through networking, I was able to get into the main frame, you know, like into the main database, and then work from there. And then with that knowledge, I was able to do anything I wanted, be it DMV, Social Security, just anything, you know, just anything. And the reason why I liked company computers was because they were so vast. Because back then they were just giant Unix monsters, you know, with VAX and VMS. I mean, they were just monsters, and it was just nuts. While people were getting into like college computers, into their supercomputers, I was getting into the corporation's supercomputers, which was running the same thing, you know. And that's why I started learning, how can I put it, how to create people, you know, like that was my first initiation to, like, you know, I guess you would call it identity theft today, you know, like creating people, which led into a natural progression into what I've did that led up to me being in prison. With that knowledge, I was able to work around bank computers, which was mostly VMS, and back then they were just starting into Microsoft's, I think it wasn't 3.11, it was a beta test version for NT, not 4.0, but it was more of a beta for NT, which most of banking institutions started using. Mainly because of their UIs for the user interface and for the simplicity, because an idiot could work through that, you know. I started learning on how to do wire transfers, how to set up accounts, you know, like how you would set up a shell account. I started learning how to set up accounts, how to transfer money within the accounts, just locally, you know, just all in the same system. You know, I would create an account, then I would transfer money from, you know, from a corporate's account into that account. Back then, when people started stumbling upon it, they started using worms that would operating on the penny method, you know, extracting one penny from, you know, every account. Meanwhile, I was just taking whole chunks, you know, because I figured, you know, why take a penny? Because usually back then, surcharges were $2.50. You know, so why not exploit it for the gusto? At that point, I knew that the time would be the same. You know, because you start hearing of other hackers, you know, being busted for those crimes and all getting the same time. Whether they stole a penny by using, you know, a virus, i.e. a worm, or just taking whole chunks. So I figured, well, you know, would I want to take a penny or $2.50? So that's how I started, you know, with actual hacking and getting into money. Because as I normally progressed, I was blinded by money, you know, because everybody wanted money. Everybody likes nice things. Everybody wants to drive that nice car, you know. I mean, people want to live in nice and big houses. This is like the illusion that TV and, you know, people that are rich, these are things that, you know, that we as Americans are told that, you know, that we are supposed to strive for. We are supposed to, this is instituted as the American dream, you know. So, subsequently, numbers and numbers of years later, and I ended up getting into a major, how can I say this without, I used an alias. I ended up getting busted on an alias for cracking into a major computer manufacturer. Pretty much, anybody that knows me knows what that is and everything. And I ended up getting into a waste management account. Waste management is an account that any time that they make obscene profit, they put the difference of that profit into this account. These accounts are used for stock market purposes, like NASDAQ, quarterly reports. Any time that they don't think that they're going to meet their quarterly report financially, they would withdraw money out of this account to meet that requirement, so that way they don't lose stock value and their investors don't start dumping stock. And pretty much every major corporation has an account like this. This is what I've learned back then. This is, I'll say, 95. And then I stumbled upon corporate cards, you know. So I started using corporate cards as a means, because people were using regular people's credit cards, you know, and those obviously had limits, you know, depending on the person's credit. You know, back then you had a 5,000, 10,000. They didn't have platinum then. They had a gold. And then they had Centurion. Centurion is the equivalent of an American Express Black card for a person, or a Visa signature card that has no limit for a regular person. Back then they were called Centurions. And so I started using those. I was able to purchase my first house. I put the closing cost on a corporate card. And then through methods of account wires, I was able to purchase my first home, which was $3.8 million, which is what I first expanded on in the beginning of the show, and a closing $4.2 million. And it was a big house. It was two stories. If you guys went to MapQuest, you guys can see it on there. Beautiful house, beautiful. And all this by the age of, like, right around 16. You know, and this was 94, 95. And subsequently, through this group, we started networking within each other, you know. And that's what I have to, like, impress upon any groups out there, is that, you know, it's one thing to know what everybody is doing, but you will exceed further if people don't know what you're doing individually within the group. You know, one hand, you know, should not know what, you know, like the left hand shouldn't know what the right is doing personally. You know, the whole basis of a group is projects, you know, to help implement projects for, you know, for the further investment of the group. But we believe that individually, you know, we were each our own, you know, our own personal islands. So I built my empire. Back then, I built my empire up to about $52 million total. That's where it stood when I subsequently got raided. I was not even in the state when I was raided. I was currently on the East Coast being prosecuted. As a matter of fact, due to an informant that I subsequently took to my house previous to that, and was able to give them the address of my house, give them the known names, known aliases that I was using at the time. All in all, I beat the feds at trial. Instead of hitting me with taking me to trial for conspiracy to commit computer crimes, which they could have had me on all day long, because they raided my house. You know, they took at least $6 million worth of equipment from me. You know, I mean, just equipment alone. I mean, nonetheless, the house and, you know, everything. All in all, everything said and done, they took about $13 million from me, all in all. And so instead of hitting me with conspiracy to commit computer crime, they turn around and they take me to trial, because I told them I want to go to trial. You know, they take me to trial on computer trespassing. And what's funny is during the preliminaries, you know, during the preliminary hearings and whatnot, and ended in the discovery, the FBI admitted that, you know, this certain computer manufacturer didn't even know that anything happened. They didn't know the money was missing. Nobody knew anything. They couldn't trace me because they didn't know that I was, you know, that I hit them at all. You know, and it was actually a pretty elaborate hack. The total hack took me about 3 days to set up and 15 minutes to execute. And so I ended up beating them on computer trespassing due to the fact that they couldn't prove that I was the one behind the computer that did it. Being that, you know, there was obviously no, you know, quote-unquote crime beyond a reasonable doubt that was committed. All they could prove was, you know, I was too big for my britches. You know, I had way too much money than what I was supposed to have. So what they did was they went ahead and called the IRS. They initially did that to further the investigation on me. But that ended up not working because I ended up getting acquitted. But the IRS hit me with tax evasion. They seized my property, all my equity, everything. They got about $13 million out of me. They hit me with a $1.5 million fine, which I paid in like 8 hours. I ended up paying them with this computer manufacturer's own money of the $6 million that I transferred because I printed out seven in payroll checks, and I started spending those, but that's another show. And I ended up going to prison for forgery, for a limousine, and that's all that they could get me on in the end. So I get out, I lose everything, I get out of prison, I parole out back out to California, and for reasons unbeknownst to anybody, they thought I was committing more crime. And since I was not gainfully employed while on Interstate Compact for parole out in California, they close interest on my Interstate Compact in California. And they told me to pack my bags and go back to New York to finish out the duration of my parole. When I got back to parole in New York, they turned around, and instead of saying that I couldn't have access to computers, they turned around and said I couldn't have access to phones, business or residential, and that the only phones I could use were payphones. Now, if they would have read my discovery, they would have learned that the only time I ever used phones at all to commit crime was payphones and cell phones. Those were the only mode of telecommunications that I would use to commit my crimes. And yet, they were affording me this opportunity again. They thought that, you know, by saying that I couldn't have access to a business phone, which in turn eliminated me from any sense of a job, being that the first condition of parole is I will seek and maintain employment. That is the first condition of parole on the New York State parole green sheet that they give you. Number two is, what was number two? Number two is irrelevant. Number one was I will seek and maintain employment. So they basically told me that I couldn't, you know, have a job because I could not have access to phones. I could not work at a place where there was a phone or anything. I couldn't even do manual labor, you know, i.e. construction, because when I would have to go collect my check, I would have to go into the construction trailer where there was a phone, you know. So I wasn't able to even have a job while on parole my first time. So what I did was, being in Broome County, which was my county of conviction here in Binghamton, New York, I decided to have the bright idea to get pissed off at the government. You know, these guys want to fuck me. I'm going to inadvertently fuck them back. Not the government, but Broome County. being that, you know, the only problems that I had on parole was with Broome County, not California, because I didn't have these stipulations when I was out in California. I mean, everything was gravy out in California. But, so, in New York, I turn around and get back into corporate cards. So, I make some calls, and I get more corporate cards, because corporate cards have no limits, as long as you have Fortune 500 and Fortune 100 cards of executives. They have no limits. So I decide to lock down all the gas stations in Broome County. You know, out here we have like Hess, Mobil, Citgo. We have like local gas stations, Manly's. So I decide to lock those down with money orders, cigarettes, and liquor. You know, and I would pay for these on the corporate cards. And Mobil at the time started selling prepaid phone cards, which inadvertently I would go ahead and get on the corporate cards, reprogram them, take them off for prepaid status, and then just make them, you could call them burnout phones that were untraceable. And then I would turn around and sell those for 500 apiece per handset. And I was working with another person that worked at a Mobil in Broome County. And that person was stealing prepaid cell phone cards because I wouldn't give him a burnout phone, because I figured I was already giving him well more than, you know, the actual cell phone, you know, to reprogram it, because I was paying him. I was letting him hang out with me. I know that sounds egotistical, but if you understood what I was doing at the time and the things I was doing, then it would just be well worth it. You know, he hung out with me about maybe a good 18 hours out of the day. I would take him on limo trips. I mean, just go anywhere we wanted to go. You know, I would give him money. You know, I bought his mom's house. You know, I bought the mortgage, so that way his mother lived free and clear of mortgage. You know, I did a lot for this guy. So this guy turned around at his work and steals about the equivalent of $400 worth of prepaid cell phone cards for the prepaid phone. Management goes back through the receipts and sees that the equivalent of $400 is missing out of the till, quote unquote. So they go back through the surveillance tapes and they see him taking these prepaid cell phone cards. And so what they do is they turn around and they suspend him, you know, pending further investigation, you know, go further back in the surveillance tapes to see if he did any more fraud at the store. The stuff that we did on the corporate cards never came up whatsoever, because all the transactions went through without a hitch. So they just concluded that, you know, the $400 was missing because, you know, he stole these prepaid cell phone cards. So they let him back in the store for about a week to see if he would steal more from the store. He didn't, because from that point I stopped using his store, you know, as part of my run, because I had a run. I would go to all the gas stations and get money orders, you know, for $2,500 a piece. So, all in all, I would walk out of there with two money orders of $2,500. So that's $5,000. I would walk out with anywhere from 8 to 12 cases of cigarettes. I would walk out with about maybe 5 or 6 boxes of prepaid cell phone cards and a couple of cases of, you know, alcohol, beer. So, once the manager at his store realized that, you know, he wasn't frauding anymore, within that week that they would kept him under surveillance without his knowledge, they decided to call the sheriff. The sheriff comes out to, you know, take a statement from the manager before he showed up for work, and then come back later that day to arrest my co-defendant. Well, what is soon to be my co-defendant. So, when the sheriff shows up, my co-defendant thinks that it's because of what we did, you know, with the corporate cards. So, instead of, because when the sheriff arrested him, the sheriff didn't even have enough time to tell him why he was under arrest before he said, "I know why you're here." And then, of course, you know, the sheriff ain't going to say, "Yes, I'm here because, you know, you stole some prepaid cell phone cards." He's going to say, "Oh, really? Tell me more." So then my co-defendant went about the elaborate tale of what we were doing and the extent of it. So subsequently, I get picked up. I get charged for two stores, which is his and ASICO. So I go up on a second bid. I end up going on a second bid. I took all the way. I never snitched on anybody. And I go up on a second bid up in prison. So when I got out this last time here, I got let off parole early, I believe because of a new law. I also have suspicions of why they let me off early, just to see maybe if I would do something to get myself back in jail. But I wanted to parole out to California on this last bit here. Parole wouldn't take me because they banned, I did not know this, but Sacramento banned me, Sacramento being the capital of California, banned me from the state of California until I was off of parole. While I was in prison this last time, my mother died from cancer, and I was unable to attend her funeral service. I lost everything, you know. My mother, she was okay with what I did. She wasn't okay with it. Let me restate that. She was okay with it to the point, in her words, I would rather have you rob banks the way that you do than you run up into the bank with a gun and get yourself shot. So we had a mutual understanding, you know. I mean, we had a, you know, a level to see eye to eye with and stuff. So at least when she died, you know, she understood what I did and why I was doing it. But, you know, she would never take any of the money that I received from it. So she stayed in the, you know, she basically stayed, you know, in the trailer where I grew up at and everything. And it really hurt me, but I understand where she was coming from. You know, this took me a long time to get over. It really did. And so when she died, I was currently in prison here in New York State. There was no relatives. My father died 10 days before my 7th birthday, so, you know, my father wasn't even in the picture. All my relatives are dead. You know, I mean, I'm the last of the bloodline here. All my relatives on my mother's and my father's side are dead. So there was nobody. There was absolutely nobody there to oversee a funeral, to oversee proper storage of, you know, like pictures, my father's war books, you know, things like that. So I basically lost everything. Like, I don't even have a picture of my mother. I have nothing. When she died, all that just went. So when I got out this time, I really had to fight myself because I was so mad at the world, you know, just so damn mad at the world. And so mad at what I lost. I mean, this computer manufacturer never get the money back. They could only trace the money to three different banks overseas, and then they lost it after that. During the course, that was from my first bid, during the course of that time, that money, being that it is in an overseas mutual, has grown to, let's see, how can I say this? To the high eight figures, you know. And I'm scared to go pick that up now. You know, because I don't know if they're just saying that they didn't find it, if this computer manufacturer says that they're done with it, but, you know, I mean, this computer manufacturer obviously has hackers, you know, working for them. I mean, every, you know, computer corporation does. You know, I mean, there's corporate hackers that are hired all the time, you know, under white hat purposes, of course, you know. So I may have to end up walking away from that. So I lost, built, and lost an empire. Let's see, one, two, and right now I'm building a third empire, except this time I'm doing it legitimately, you know. And I think that's really pisses the government off now that I'm doing it legitimately, because I could have done it legitimately before. It's just instead of taking, you know, the time out, you know, taking the 90 days out in order to build this again, you know, I would have rather made three times the amount of money that I would have made within that 90 days and then just do it in anywhere from 10 to a half an hour, 10 minutes to a half an hour. You know, so I feel that deep down, I feel that I betrayed the scene, you know, that I betrayed the hacking and the freaking scene, because I sort of exploited my skills, you know, and even though I did give, you know, things back to the scene, you know, like I hooked people up with laptops, I hooked them up with money. You know, but, you know, where's the knowledge? You know, these things are all just material. You know, I mean, you know, God forbid a house fire ever hits them and they lose it. You know, so I never really did anything when I made the money to support the scene. You know, I tried, you know, schooling proteges because I was ready to retire. And my first accomplice, slash co-defendant, was supposed to be my protege because I was going to retire, you know, because even though I was coming in on the back end of it, you know, I got old school ethics, you know, inbred in me in the scene, to where when you retire, you know, you're supposed to teach everything you know to one person, and that person is supposed to carry on your legacy and then build on top of that. You know, I don't think that that should ever stop, you know, but it's difficult now because now everything has to be legit. In the real world of being legitimized, it's a lot harder because now, you know, you're faced with taxes. I mean, I'm 26 now, you know, I mean, the age of a hacker, the average age is anywhere between 13 and 17. You know, that is when you're in your hacking prime. You know, that's when you have, you know, a real fire for knowledge. That is when you are really, you know, at the peak in your, you know, in your own skill levels. And so I should have retired. I should have retired back then when I was, let's see, probably about 19, I was about to retire. 1920, because I spent my 21st birthday in jail instead of in a bar getting hammered, which I currently am right now. And so I just feel that I let the scene down. So what I decided to do now legitimately is start up a project of mine called Hacksaw Radio. And I was able to get Avid over there. You still with us, Avid?
Yep.
All right. And with the help of Hairball and HBX, you still there, Hairball?
Yes.
I decided to go ahead and implement Hacksaw Radio with HBX. And to give you a little synopsis on, you know, where HBX and Hacksaw Radio is going, Hacksaw Radio is going to be the media version of HBX in the scene. It's going to be the audio slash video in the future. We're going to be throwing cons. And what I'm going to do I am really going to do for the scene is raise the bar, which is something I should have done when I was 20. And we are going to take all of our affiliates, and we are all going to raise the bar in the name of the scene, which is why we are coming out with Hacksure. You know, instead of being called hackers, we are now fucking called Hacksures. Everybody that is in the pursuit of knowledge and in it just for the knowledge, because it is only knowledge that we are kicking. That is why we are Hacksures. You know, and I really don't like opening up, you know, USA Today and reading about a malicious hacker that decided to deface some government website, you know, to try and make a name for themselves because they think that that's what hacking is all about. I really don't like hackers on conferences and IRC channels and forums saying that, you know, somebody that is just coming into the scene, you know, a newbie, you know, is lame because they ask a question that a hacker deems as stupid. You know, we all had to start from somewhere, you know, and I believe that we all that are in the pursuit of knowledge, we Hacksures have a duty to properly teach these newbies, you know, because when we're not going to be in this forever, you know, I mean, sure, eventually we're going to sell out, you know. I mean, everybody sells out, you know. It's only about what your next project is after you sell out. You're only a sellout if you don't start another project. Remember that. I mean, you all, if you ever get status to where you start up a organization, you know, I'm hoping that some of you out there that's listening to the sound of my voice right now, if you ever start up .coms and sell out, don't stop there. You know, don't enjoy the money. You know, the money is just a benefit. Money is a tool. That's all it is. Money is nothing but a tool. Money is not happiness, because happiness is just a state of mind. You could be penniless and be happy. You know, and these are things that we forget every day, because I did. I mean, I really did. I was on top of my game. I was a millionaire twice, you know, a bona fide millionaire twice before the age of 26. I still am. I just don't know if I want to go claim the money because I'm scared. You know, I'm scared. I don't want to get shot. You know, I don't want to get fucking shot. You know, I was never into dealing secrets to foreign governments. I was never into espionage. I would never commit treason against our country, because that is not what hacking is about. You know, it's about fucking knowledge. You know, and we really need to start learning that again. I think that is seriously what is wrong with the scene. You know, that, you know, you got these hackers out there that are, you know, seriously warping the minds of people that are just getting into the scene, you know, to where, you know, if you're a freak, you know, you're not elite unless you know what the fucking acronym stands for. Who gives a fuck about RC Mac? You know? I mean, shit, you know, they're just a fucking ticket pusher. It's all about the core, and it's all about the motherfucking switch. Fuck a ticket. You know, because if you can social the core, and you can social the switch, who needs a fucking ticket? Come on. You people need to fucking start learning again. Seriously, learning. I mean, shit, we all do. Learning is a never-ending process. And yes, I am ranting right now. You know. And preaching a little. But damn it, this has to be said. So, everybody out there, just watch. Watch where HBX and Hacksaw Radio goes in the future. You know? Keep it scene-based. We have to support the fucking scene as a whole. We have to. Because if you do not support the scene, and you call yourself a hacker, the scene will die. It will. You know, don't put out bullshit. Don't put out third-hand information. Get out there and learn something. You freaks out there, you think something's dead? Prove it to yourself that it's dead. Just like what Avid said. Prove to yourself. Don't go off of what somebody else said. Because when you regurgitate that shit, you make yourself look lame. And you don't know who's listening. You never know who's listening. When I was on loops and conferences, those are the people I feared. I feared the people that never talked. Because you never know who's listening. You never know. I mean, we all know the government's listening. I mean, they're listening to this episode right now. Right now, as we record. They're probably listening. That's irrelevant. That is irrelevant. And I'll tell you why. Because if it was relevant, you know, they would have never allowed the internet. You know, you can think up of all the conspiracy theories that you want to. But if them shutting us up was even, you know, a little piece of the bigger picture, a lot of the freedoms that we have now would not exist. Just would not exist. You can have theories about how they're going to try and control hackers through pedophiles and laws that they pass about pedophiles. But if you're a hacksaw, if you're elite, you're operating outside of those standards. Just remember that. This is Johnny Hacksaw. Anything you guys want to promote?
No.
No? Have it?
No.
No? Remember, catch episodes at Hacksaw Radio. com, HAXORRADIO.com. I want to thank you all for listening to episode 11. And sorry if that was harsh for you guys to hear, but it had to be said, man. It really did. This is episode 11, The Heart of Hacksaw Radio, Full Disclosure. And we're out.
Yo, Johnny Hacker, hone it down for Hacksaw Radio. Y'all ready for this? Freestyle, motherfuckers. Let's hear you amp it up. Let's go. That's right. 206-888-5819. Pulling another late night, skills up to par for this heist. And there ain't nothing to the game but computer code terabytes. It's like broken dagger in the back of my limousine, but I let you watch my fingers fly across the keys. Cause I'm hacking drugs off of a bubbly. And billions of dollars are flashing on my screen, allowing me to eat lovely. So the feds are trying to find where I'm at. But according to them, I'm at all points on the map. What's missing is traceable, the ghosts are trying to catch. Won't they learn, my crew, we can never be tracked. What can I say in this game, we know how to act. Which is currently nothing but the fact that if you don't know, then you just got hacked. I'm in a penthouse suite on the roof. It's either palace for chilling the fans, kicking the knowledge. Laptops open to create malice. Now the NSA's trying to make moves on us. Several attempts to get us are really sad, but just in case, I got a jet range on the helipad. There ain't no telling, I might have to duck out fast, but it's okay, cause I've completed my task. Cause I got 500 million hidden in my soft stock. Fed a little off the clock, now it's a security exchange commission, not mock. Sometimes even I wonder if I can ever be stopped. Are there secret indictments against me? Probably not. Yet I know all good things must come to an end, so I've already prepared the virus. Now do you want me to hit send? I got liquid latex on my fingertips just to make sure nothing comes back on my prints. Don't know why the feds don't call it quits, cause I'll never be around to see the indictment. So once again, it's on. The chase begins and now I'm gone. Just one more story to add to the files of a Sabadon. I'm living any lifestyle I please with no intrusions. Chasing after things of the world and believing the illusions. Retire my ego and everything it produces, but no more. I'm now illuminous. Cause I only spent 3 hours in jail before I posted a $250,000 bail. Now the feds are pissed that they lost my tail, and manipulating the system so easy it never fails. So tell the man to fill up the plane, cause I'll make it overnight and land the same. Then I'll change my name, I'll raise low in the game. Let's see more money, power, respect, and fame. Let the feds scramble, cause ain't a damn thing change. I'm now in total control. I'm only one keystroke away from hacking Interpol. Just tell me which nation you wanna go, cause I'll be making $1 million off this Wolfer card I sold. Isn't the highlight really beautiful? Cause in the end it won't even matter no more. Now she's with the extended visual. So here I come, straight out of the west, flying coast to coast on that charterless jet, sport by Davis, Navarex, rocking corporate cards issued by American Express. I tell you, it's computers that first started my initiative. Once I got in, I couldn't get out because the game was too lucrative. Now money ain't even an issue no more, so I lay back with friends and let the champagne flow. I stay with laptops to increase my dough, bank that shit overseas and watch my empire grow, laughing at the FBI like a big joke. Now because of my knowledge and skills, I'll never be broke. So roll up that blunt and take a toke and let the smoke raise your penival as we ascend the conscious of the extended visual. Yo, you know none of you can fuck with me. Motherfucking Johnny Hacker holding it down, bitch. About to go for round two up in this piece. You thought you had round one? Wait for round two, nigga. So yo. Another night, another intrusion. Had to divert my call a couple of times to leave them in confusion. You won't find which line I'm using, leaving me time in the system I'm abusing. I'm downloading all your secrets, post them on the web so everyone can see them. Never catch me, I'm always fleeing. Lying, if you catch me, say it's treason. It was you who started in the beginning without reason. You know retaliation is a bitch, but you never should have said I caused a computer glitch. So everything I do now, you should be able to live with. Yo, my password's accepted. You're pissed off now cause your whole system's infected. You tried to stop me but your attempts were rejected, and it made you so mad you took a sledgehammer and wrecked it. 15 years ago there was only 7 of us wanting better lifestyles and dreaming of the big bucks. Now the millennium started and we mobbing 40 million plus. That's more people than the feds could ever hope to buzz. You can never get us all, not even make a dent. You're scared to death hoping we relent. With statistics like these, do you think we'll ever repent? Last year alone, how many viruses in the computer game, keep yourself free and clear. As you find more and more, things aren't as they appear. Never fuck with teams, their envy will have you in prison wearing state greens. Out of sight, out of mind, turns the tide to shattered dreams. In my world, there's no friends, just temporary alliance, networking together in the name of digital science. Yo, Sam be nibbling, Sam be quick, but Sam wasn't fast enough to trace my shit. Now Sam wants me to quit, cause he's had nothing else to add to the indictment. Ain't no way I'll let him off lightly. Motherfucking Sam still trying to fight me. Hit you hard with the Trojan. Can't you see you're outcoded? I'm not mad you after that promotion, only that you lack devotion. And yet, with all that, you're still making a motherfucking commotion. I love this technology I'm using. This occupation's so cool to other people, it's confusing. Hack your bank so fast they can't count the money they're losing. You can't ever fuck with me. You've can't even trace me, going through satellites left and right and right and left and this and south and off into the night like a bandit. Because we're finally getting to where we're supposed to be by spitting truth to will. It scares the Illuminati. Wondering how long they'll let me be before I end up like Tupac and Biggie. But I know they'll come pretty soon. But it'll not be pending my doom. And my life is infinite and this universe has room. It's really messed up to be in my position, because this truth is for a chosen few and not the opposition. It's been closed for years, and yet only 99% choose not to hear, while the West wallow in sorrow and dragon tears. The masses, they can never be in control, because their beliefs are too easily swayed when the Powerball rolls. And yet all these things will take their toll, mounting aggressions that will create the end of the world. Because I write these rhymes to make your head split, leave your ears ringing so you want to rewind it. Spitting truth to will, it leaves you blindsided, wondering how I could write it. What I put forth ain't even the tip of the iceberg. Lies and half-truths is what you learned. I'm spitting truth to your soul to make it burn. The light on a path that you deeply yearn, helping you see the elixir you need to earn. I'm verifying the foundations of 3-7, setting firm, distorting on this journey with each twist and turn. And yes, to show your dumb ass home so you can return. They're trying to run me up on wire fraud. Western Union thinks they slick about a videotape no one ever saw. And yet it was all acquitted, never took the downfall. What? Yeah, you can't fuck with this motherfucking Johnny Hacker at Hacksaw Radio. This is the motherfucking freestyle, bitch. Hold it down. 206-888-5819. The Hacksaw Radio Directory. Check it out.